with no further ado, let's get right to our VIP line. George Brockler is the district attorney for the 18th Judicial District of Colorado, the largest by population in the state. Remind me, Arapahoe County, Lincoln County, what else? Douglas?
And Elbert.
And Elbert. Okay, there we go. Good morning, George.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Russ.
Glad to. So there's a story a couple days ago over on Fox 31 Denver. Headline, Aurora man pleads guilty to sixth DUI, sentenced to probation. And, George, I've seen a few stories like this, and I think maybe more than one has actually been in your district. And I'm getting a little pissed off because I thought, and call me crazy, that Colorado passed a law regarding DUI felony.
We did. And in fact, this guy was convicted by plea of the felony DUI. But, you know, when Colorado took that big leap forward to join, I think it was 44 or 45 other states in the country that had a felony DUI law, where it came up short was in the mandatory sentencing part of the charge. And as you probably know, the legislature, some for fiscal reasons, but I think a lot for philosophical reasons, is just very reluctant these days to impose any sort of mandatory sentence on repeat and aggravated offenders. In fact, I think you should expect to see a bill this year authored by the defense bar through some Democrat legislator that will seek to pull all of the mandatory sentencing off of every single charge except murder.
Now, this is an area where, I don't know, you and I might not agree on this one. I don't mean on this particular case. A guy who is convicted of a sixth DUI should be in jail. But I don't love the idea of mandatory anything, really. And I wonder if you can put aside for a minute the specifics of this case from your point of view as a prosecutor and understanding the justice system well. Should we have that little faith in judges that legislators should be the ones to say what a minimum sentence needs to be?
I think on the handful of charges for which mandatory minimums exist, the answer is yes. And the reason that they came into place is that, you know, 25 years-ish ago, when violent crime was much higher than it is now, we saw incredibly disparate sentences on similar facts and backgrounds across the metro area in the state. And that's why the then existing legislature stepped in to say, listen, we need to do something here. We need to set a floor below which, if you commit these limited offenses, you have the promise of prison, some type of incarceration behind you. We're not talking about shoplifting, theft, even burglary. Do you know, in this state, you can drive drunk and kill another human being, your wife, your child, and still be probation eligible. We're talking about a handful of charges for which a conviction, it doesn't equate to probation. We're talking about violent sexual assaults. We're talking about murder. We're talking about attempted murder. We're talking about significant violent crimes involving the use of weapons and causing bodily injury or serious bodily injury. The kinds of crimes for which you'd have to rack your brain and torture yourself to come up with a factual scenario where you'd say, yep, that's a person that should still be walking the streets among us.
What is the difference, not in concept, I'm clear on the concept,
yep,
but in terms of how it actually works in the real world in situations where there are mandatory minimums versus guidelines? How often do judges go outside the guidelines in either direction, actually?
Well, it depends on how you mean guidelines. So, for instance, that vehicular homicide charge I just referenced to you, that has a 4 to 12-year presumptive range DOC sentence, but because it's not mandatory prison, someone could be sentenced to probation with no incarceration. They could be sentenced to work release or some small amount of jail up to 90 days as a condition of probation or even community corrections, which in some cases, repeat DUI guys, like in this case, is appropriate. Judges use the discretion that they're given. They don't do what the DA says. They do the things that they think are best given the latitude provided in the legislature by the legislature and the facts that are presented before them. My point in saying that there are still charges for which we need mandatory minimums are there are some factual situations, some people that continue to break our most serious laws and put us at risk for which we need to say your discretion is limited. This person has to go.
Another case that came up recently, and I wonder if this falls into exactly the same situation, the same category for you. So on the one hand, we're talking about a guy on his sixth DUI, clearly a repeat offender and clearly a danger to society. Another, there's another case just a couple of days ago, and this is not in your district, but in Colorado, where a former University of Colorado student was convicted of basically raping a drunk woman who couldn't, you know, stand up for herself. And according to the Daily Camera article, he was pretending to care for this woman. And a Boulder judge sentenced him to work release and probation, even though actually even up there in Boulder, they were trying to get real jail time.
It's frustrating. Again, this highlights another area where we have been reluctant to impose these mandatory type sentences on some of these serious charges, like sexually assaulting the helpless and vulnerable. And yet you're going to find judges that are willing to go down the road of concluding that the prison sentence may be so bad for the offender that something else short of that can be accomplished. In my mind, it is hard for me to envision, as the father of a teenage daughter, a situation like the one that took place in Boulder, especially where this guy, by the way, goes to court, goes to trial, and throughout that, the demeanor he exhibits, at least through the article, is one of somewhat aloofness or arrogance or treats it like it's a flippant thing. And it's only after he's convicted that he finds Jesus, I guess, and comes to the podium and acts contrite and is apologetic. That kind of guy can't just get probation, I think, in the minds of most Coloradans.
And we all heard that just unbelievable story of that kid out of Stanford. With it, and this seems a little bit similar to me. They both raped drunk women and both got a slap on the hand. Let's bring this back out to a macro thing a little bit, George. Yep. I think there was a time, maybe especially in 1990s, maybe led in a national way by Rudy Giuliani, where the country and politicians were very, very tough on crime. I think there's a view now that certain aspects of that were overdone. Maybe the war on drugs not working so well. Maybe we're spending too many billions of dollars on incarceration. And maybe while not going soft on crime, there may be a middle ground. Where are you on this?
Well, one, I think that these very heavy-handed federal drug sentences are ones that have proven to be largely ineffective. And I think the impact that they've had on families and communities, where there has got to be some accountability and punishment there, it's been too much. And you've seen Colorado respond to that positively. Within the last few years, Colorado completely overhauled its entire drug criminal code. We don't even have felonies for drugs anymore. We call them drug felonies. And we've created situations where even if someone goes to trial and gets convicted of possession of usable amounts of drugs, that if they successfully complete treatment and therapy, as the court orders, that felony automatically becomes a misdemeanor.
And are you fine with that?
I am.
Okay.
I mean, listen, at the end of the day, I do not want to spend taxpayer money warehousing addicts. That is not only is bad fiscal sense and policy sense, it's bad morally. I mean, I think we have an obligation to try to make people in our community better, and I do believe in rehabilitation, but it can't be all one thing and not the other. I would be more in favor of a quicker, surer, shorter sentence for a great number of crimes out there than we have. We have a system where we have fed this notion that we're going to let it drag out forever. We're going to use as many resources as humanly possible, and then 2 years later, after someone's held accountable, then reluctantly we'll push them into a super long-term sentence. I'm not sure that's good for anyone, not the victim, not the community, not the family members affected. There are other steps we can take, but I'll tell you who's been taking them are the states. States have been at the front of this. Federal government is way, way behind.
Do you have an opinion on the DEA's refusal to remove marijuana from Schedule 1?
That's tough, isn't it? I mean, I'm a 10th Amendment guy. And so, you know, when there are laws out there at the federal level that are used to thwart the will of the people on something like marijuana, it's a struggle for me because, look, I believe that the majority of the people get to amend their constitution to make certain things legal, and whether I like it or not, I'm bound by that. And you've got the federal government stepping in, and I don't know what to think about it. I think marijuana is dangerous. I do think it leads to other addictions. I'm sure there's people out there right now screaming at their radios. But I also think we ought to take some steps to try to study it more, and I appreciate the federal government's willingness to open up that portion of it to allow some more testing. But we've got to figure out a way to get the federal government out of the way of individuals and states more than we have.
So that raises another question. Now I'm going to ask you something that's closer to philosophy than law.
Sure.
And I didn't even intend to go this way with the conversation, but George and I always have such great conversations on the air or just over a little bit of food. I love talking to you. You think about things.
Yeah.
And that is, so you said that you think marijuana is dangerous and leads to other addictions. And I'm not going to debate that with you.
Yeah.
My question is, if that's true, and if people are using marijuana, adults in their own homes, not driving under the influence or operating heavy machinery under the influence, if it is true that it is dangerous and can lead to other addictions, does criminalizing it, does that make it the government's business?
No. Listen, I do not believe that there's a prosecutor out there that I know of that wants to get into someone's basement or living room and criminalize them smoking a joint with their friends or their adult loved ones. I don't know any prosecutor that wants to waste time doing it. Problem is, it never stays in the basement or the living room or even the backyard. It spills out onto the streets, and what we see are the ancillary effects of this. Look at the 16th Street Mall. Look at these pockets of people flowing into the state for this transient marijuana-related lifestyle.
Yeah, the so-called travelers.
Right, right.
Drives me nuts.
That are directly related to this. The other part of this, too, is as we move towards the possibility of universal health care in Amendment 69, now all of a sudden you have made other individuals' health decisions that should be their own business. Now they got to be your and my business, Ross, because we're talking about limited resources. We're talking about the likelihood of the kind of queuing that we see in Canada and England. And now I've got to care what kind of food this person puts in their body.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to care about what drugs or what they smoke, because it's going to directly impact my bottom line and my family's access to health care. That is a limitation on my liberty.
I agree with you. And I, for what it's worth, George, I think that thing is going to suffer one of the biggest defeats that you've ever seen for anything on the ballot in Colorado. But we'll see. So I agree with you that legal recreational marijuana is attracting these. How do I describe these people as willfully, voluntarily homeless to the 16th Street Mall and other places around Denver because they want to get high, and I got no use for them at all. Now, on the other side of the coin, in your job as a prosecutor, are you seeing any decline in, let's say, gang marijuana-related crime that you could say, well, maybe it's not an equal trade, but at least there is some benefit on the legalization side?
I don't think so. I mean, I think what we've seen is a complete drop off in the number of possession of usable amounts of marijuana charges, because, you know, they have to be publicly consumed, you know, in a place that's violative of the law. And we just don't see as many of those. But what we do see instead, and again, the federal government touches this piece too, right? Because we don't allow the people in the legal portion of the marijuana trade to use banks,
mm-hmm,
and to use that kind of a system. So it's an all-cash business. Well, the gray market, and I don't know why we call it a gray market, the black market for marijuana, for these folks that are growing marijuana in their homes or homes that they rent in nice communities, they turn them into Jurassic Park on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
They have more than they can consume. And they don't just flush it down the toilet or set fire to it. They sell it out the back door. And that market right there, what we've seen is an uptick in violence, not from people using marijuana, but from the transactional part of marijuana. People are coming to these deals, these black market deals, with marijuana and or cash, and the other one is trying to rip them off. We have seen a handful of those. We've seen several homicides related to that. In fact, I think there were some stories done on it out of Aurora. So it's too early to tell. I mean, listen, I don't want to come out and say, hey, the sky is falling and it's turning into the Wild West out there, but I can't tell you that, hey, overnight crime has dropped off in this area. Everything's rosy. We're now able to focus on just the rapists who are ultimately going to get probation. Instead, I say there's some things here that I don't think we knew about or anticipated, or at least the public didn't when they voted on this. Let's figure out how to address these things.
George Brockler, the district attorney of the 18th Judicial District, right here in the state of Colorado. Look, I appreciate your time, as always. Actually, let me ask you one last question before we go. The original story that we started this conversation about, the Aurora guy who pled guilty to, this was his sixth DUI. If you were, not just the prosecutor, but you were the judge, what would you have sentenced that guy to?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because this wasn't hang them high, lock them up, and throw away the key approach that we took. In fact, the pre-sentence investigation that's generated by the probation department recommended what we recommended, which was 4 years of community corrections, which is the doorstep to prison, but it keeps you out of prison. And that first year of it, up to that first year of it, is residential. It's a locked facility where they make sure that you either take the antabuse, attend the therapy, do not drive, go to your job that really exists. It is intensive and it is confinement, but it is not prison. And then they work on the difficult process of transitioning you back into the community. That's what I thought was appropriate for this guy. And there's a lot of them like that that we try to approach that with. It isn't just for this guy, too. He'd been to prison for 3 years in Missouri for the same thing. Prison isn't the only answer for this guy, and I thought we had an opportunity here to put him in a position to guarantee a better outcome. As it is now, I don't know. I don't know who's monitoring him. I love the probation department. They do a great job. They're overwhelmed by cases, and they don't have the ability to do a lot more than have people come see them in their office or call them on the phone. That's just not sufficient for this kind of a guy.
To me, you know, just gut reaction as a human being, I just feel scared to have a six-time DUI, convicted DUI driver on the roads, especially knowing that he probably feels at this point like he can get away with anything. That's what scares me.
Well, and you're right to be scared in this way. Look, you and I can limit our exposure to crime and our risk to being victims by where we live, where we conduct ourselves, when we conduct ourselves, who we conduct ourselves with. But one thing you and I can't do is to protect ourselves from drunk drivers, because I'm telling you, over 2 decades of doing this, I've prosecuted countless DUIs in court, through pleas, all over. And they happen on every part of the street at every time of day. You can scan the Denver Post over the last 10 years, and my guess is you would find a DUI fatality in every part of the state at some different part of the day, daytime, nighttime, weekends, weekdays. It doesn't matter. When your family and my family are on the road, we are safe because we trust that the person next to us will honor the painted lines on the road.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a huge deal when you take away your ability to judge the paint on the road well, or the stop signs, or the little lights that keep us careening into each other at 55 miles an hour. That's why drunks are so scary, and that's why we have to treat them super seriously, is because it is tantamount to shooting a bullet into a crowd. Maybe you don't hit someone, but oh my God, we got to stop that.
George Brockler, DA of the 18th Judicial District, largest by population in the state of Colorado. Thanks for your time. Thanks for your good work. Look forward to talking to you again, and have a great weekend, George.
Anytime, Ross. Thank you so much.
All right.
Take care.
You too.